Welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. I'm Sarah Hawley.
And I'm Jenny Nordback.
Today we're here with Aaron Galloway, the Associate Director of Publicity at Berkeley. We talk about what exactly a publicist does, how an author can build an audience, and her favorite books. We recorded this episode a while ago and then had a flood of interviews tied to book release dates, so some of the upcoming books we talk about are already out, which means you can go buy them. Without further ado, here is our interview with Aaron Galloway.
So we are here with Aaron Galloway, who is the Associate Director of Publicity for Berkeley, and she's in town from New York. So we snatched her while she was in LA so we could sit down. And we initially, I think, thought of just having, you know, drinks or breakfast or something and socializing, and then realized we would basically be recording an episode, just not recording it. So we are going to do that and record it for your listening pleasure. So as a publicist, maybe you could give us like an intro to publicity. And I've got some specific questions about that, because I think it's something a lot of, well, readers, but authors just really don't know very much about. It's this mysterious world where you make publicity things work. But then we thought we would also dig into some of your romance tastes and that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I think the way I thought about it was authors dream of many things when they're writing, you know, finishing that first manuscript and landing an agent and a book deal and seeing their book on a shelf for the first time and hitting the New York Times bestseller list. And publicity doesn't ever really factor into it, but it's kind of a critical component of like, all right, you've written the world's greatest masterpiece. How does it find an audience? And that's a missing piece for a lot of people. And that's where you come in. So can you give us sort of the overview of what that means?
Yeah, sure. So that is where my magical fairy dust comes in. The cool thing about publicity is that it's always changing and shifting. The challenging thing about publicity is that it's never guaranteed. So a lot of people don't know the difference between publicity and marketing. And the, you know, the easy way that I always break it down is you can pay for marketing, you can't pay for publicity. Publicity really is persuasion. It is persuading somebody to love a book as much as I do, to pay attention to it solely based on my word, you know, that what I'm telling them is convincing and accurate. So a lot of publicity is building relationships, so that the people you're going back to on a regular basis, when you say this book is phenomenal, they go, oh, okay, I'm really willing to take a look at it. The advantage that I have is I do romance every day, all the time. So I have a lot of the same contacts that I've built up over the years. And that's the joy of it for me, that I really get to know these people well and work with them on a regular basis. And I don't love change. So that's why I really like working on the same thing all the time. I have friends that would call themselves generalists. They work on a whole variety of fiction or nonfiction, and they love always meeting new media contacts and developing new relationships. And look, the romance world is always getting new reviewers, new bloggers, new media that's willing to cover romance. So I still get to do some of that, perhaps not quite as frequently as some of my friends and colleagues do. But in terms of day-to-day stuff, it's everything from writing galley letters and media letters, you know, convincing members of the media, bloggers, podcasters, to, you know, review or cover one of the books or authors that I'm working on. And on the fun side, I also plan book tours, which, okay, the planning is challenging and fun. It's a lot of logistics. And if you think in spreadsheets and timetables like I do, then it's wonderful.
I love spreadsheets.
Oh my gosh. I have one of my colleagues, I really like spreadsheets, light her up inside. She literally, when you tell her she gets to make an Excel document, she just glows with joy. So that's some of what, you know, I do. And then there's the less glamorous stuff, like do mailings, and, you know, pull media lists and, you know, decide who I'm going to reach out to on a regular basis. But really the whole aim of my job is to get attention for the books that I work on, and knowing which books can get what types of attention from what media. You know, it's unlikely, for example, that an Amish romance is going to wind up in People magazine. Highly, highly unlikely. On the other hand, it is possible that a really good romantic suspense novel by a best-selling author could wind up in People magazine. You know, and it's unlikely that one of my authors would wind up on Good Morning America. Not totally inconceivable because things like that have happened, but it's simply not likely. So it's really knowing what your audience is and regularly working with these people so that you have the opportunity to come back to them with things that you really think is going to, you know, resonate with them and their audience.
And how did you get into publicity?
So I got my graduate degree from Pace University in New York, specifically in book publishing. And I really believed I was going to be an editor because, like a lot of, you know, folks that come into book publishing, that was the most visible career, you know, to me from the outside. And I really wanted to work intimately with books and authors. And I believed that the only way to do that was editorially. And I love to read. So that was really all I could imagine doing. And I started out my first job as an editorial assistant. And I was lucky because I worked at a very small house. I worked at Dorchester Publishing, may it rest in peace. And I had a fantastic experience because I wore so many different hats. And it was our VP of sales and marketing at the time who approached me about 4 months into my time as an editorial assistant. And it was because our manager of marketing and publicity at the time was leaving to pursue an opportunity at another house. And he said, well, what do you think about moving into marketing and publicity? And I thought like, well, that's the dark side. I don't know. I don't know about all that. But the great thing was, because it was a small house, he, you know, took me aside and he said, well, look, what is it that you really want to be able to do? And I said, well, I love books. I want to be able to, you know, champion them and be the person that stands behind them. He said, yeah, you know, you can do that in publicity. And because he's not a very tactful gentleman, he also said, and Aaron, your mouth is just way too big to stay in editorial. No.
That's not to say. You don't have the gentle kid gloves to deal with authors.
I think what he was attempting to tell me is that I'm a really good megaphone for books and authors and that I should be using those skills on a regular basis outside of the publishing house. So I thought, okay, I was still a little apprehensive, but I thought, let's give it a try. And I asked people that I worked with at the time afterward, when they heard I was moving into marketing and publicity, what were their thoughts? Did they think that was the right fit? And one of the editors at the time told me, you know, I realized that you could be a decent editor and that you would learn and grow. He said, but when you moved into publicity, I remember thinking, oh, that's the right fit. And that was true. I felt immediately at home and I realized, yeah, this is where I'm supposed to be. Because I'm not a line editor and I was never going to be. I could have improved my skills, but really what I excel at is this. Talking about books.
You have such an impact on a book and an author doing what you do. Like, it can be the best book in the world, but if no one knows about it, then it doesn't matter. It's never going to be read. So
yeah.
You know, in some ways you have as big or bigger an impact because you're the one who's actually getting it into readers' hands. But I want to back up a little bit because you hit on some points early on that I think you take for granted in your world. You like threw the word galley in there.
Oh, yes.
And it's
the type
so
of ship?
Funny to think. Yeah, no, exactly. You know,
or like
so
a kitchen?
All the jargon.
I had finished my first book. You know, it was going to be published by a big five house, and I had no idea what the actual life cycle of a book looked like. So I have to assume that if I was in that position, that most readers have no idea either. And yeah. This idea that there were like early copies of books that floated around there, I'm kind of glad I didn't know about because it might have made me a criminal mastermind to like get my hands on them. But so walk
you have the
through.
Manuscript. You don't need the.
No, I mean, like growing up, had I known that like they were printing early copies of all these books
book.
That no, my own book, whatever. But, like, had I known that you could like get your hands on them early, that would have probably driven me a little bit crazy. But so,
yeah.
You know, walk us through like the actual nuts and bolts of an author has finished the manuscript and, you know, there maybe the last set of copy edits still has to be done.
Yep.
But what
what does that process look like for you? Like,
yeah,
you come in there at some point mm-hmm. and you start getting some info from the author yeah. and then you're putting together a plan and sort of what does yeah. that step-by-step look like?
So I usually come in as soon as the book has been contracted for. So as soon as the author, you know, has signed on the dotted line, yes, you know, you now own my manuscript and you're going to publish it. That's normally the time that I come in. There are times that I know about a book before we actually contract for it, because one of the super cool things about being in my position is that I will have the opportunity to read option material. So if an editor is thinking about acquiring a book or is pretty sure he or she wants to acquire, then occasionally they will come to publicity and say, I'm falling in love with this. I really think it's great. Publicity-wise, how do you envision this, you know, campaign going? And there are times that I have read books and said, this needs to be published in trade paperback, not mass market, because the publicity that I can get for it will work better in trade. It doesn't mean that they always listen to me, but it is a factor. You know, it's helpful for an editor to be able to say to, you know, the publisher and the sales team, after speaking with publicity, we really think this book has magazine potential, and therefore we really need it to be in trade paperback, because the truth of the matter is most women's magazines simply do not cover mass market novels. So I have had that circumstance where I'll say this needs to be in trade from my perspective as the publicist. Doesn't always mean they listen to me. If only I ruled the world, but you know, someday. So yes, the point where I usually come in is the book is contracted. And at that point, you know, the author is turning in the finalized manuscript. It is edited by the editor and then goes into copy edits. And as soon as that first round of copy edits is done, that's typically when we are creating what's called the galley or the ARC, ARC, the advanced reader copy. And those terms are sort of tossed around now almost interchangeably. Years ago, there was some difference between them. Galleys usually didn't have cover images of the finalized book on the front. ARCs did. At this point, that delineation has really blurred, and every publicist and house kind of uses their own terminology. So that doesn't matter so much because ARC now can mean there's a cover image on the front, and it also means that there might not be. Galley, same thing. So when I use the terms, I really use them interchangeably. And the number of galleys or ARCs that you get for every book can vary wildly. And the amazing thing is that several years ago, well, I guess it'd be like 5, even 6 years ago now, depending on the publisher, we started getting digital galleys. And that made everyone's life easier because now I can send books out to anyone in 2 seconds, mm-hmm. which is amazing. Because reviewers love being able to carry multiple books around with them at once, and you can easily do that on your phone or your device, and you can get them instantaneously. And you also don't have to go hunting around for anything. And I love it because if they say they're interested or if my pitch really hooks them, they can download it immediately and begin it that night. And I can always tell how excited somebody is by a book when I send it to them. And I can go look on the website NetGalley, which is where we kind of virtually store all of the digital galleys that we have. And I can send a link or a widget, as we call it, to a reviewer or a media contact, you know, and kind of pitch them on this book. And they can, you know, hit download. So I will know how quickly they downloaded the book. This is very Big Brother. I should not be revealing this. but it's awesome to know, you know, are they really enthused by my pitch? Did this really hook them? And if it did, great. It also gives me a sense of how quickly I can follow up. Because if I sent the pitch on a Monday and they downloaded that night, well, great. Then you'll be hearing from me in a couple of days. Because if you haven't already started the book, I'm going to nudge you to do so.
I'm curious how publicity has changed now that traditional print media is struggling and a lot more publications are, you know, putting paywalls up or trying to figure out the new mode of existing. What have you noticed in terms of book publicity?
So a lot of it's online, particularly for the genre that I work on, which I don't think anyone is surprised by. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, one, print media is having a more challenging time. And even the print publications that are still very successful have cut a lot of the book coverage. I think that's probably for a variety of reasons, but they're simply trying to either keep up with or stay ahead of what they think readers' interests are. Look, if you're reading a magazine, chances are you probably also would be interested in reading a book. But then again, I know people that really consume information in very short bursts, and that's why they like magazines as opposed to books. So every print publication is trying to stay ahead and figure out what works for them. On the other hand, with the internet, you are able to cover massive amounts of content as often as you want to, essentially, as fast as your writers can keep up with the content that they want to cover. And you're also trying to reach such a large potential audience. If you think about who is on the internet at any given time, it's like a really frightening thought, actually, when you think about that. So I think it's the reason that so many different blogs and websites and even podcasts exist, because you're trying to find your segment of the audience. So I work with bloggers that really prefer to stick with, you know, paranormal, fantasy, urban fantasy novels. And that's great because I know which books to send to them. There are folks that I know that stick to, you know, Christian and inspirational romances. I think sex can be a religious experience, but I'm guessing that that's probably not what they're thinking of. So I don't reach out to those folks very often.
It's the second coming of someone.
Oh, nice. So it really is a matter of finding the best audience and the right gatekeepers for the books that I'm working on. And, you know, gatekeepers can be anyone. Now gatekeepers are bloggers, reviewers, you know, book editors, magazine editors, podcasters like yourselves, in addition to bookstagrammers. I mean, bookstagrammers, it's amazing to have seen that group really grow, because books, of course, are a visual medium. And with the dawn of Instagram and now really its total rise, there's an amazing thing that you can do creating gorgeous photos where, you know, we always say don't judge a book by its cover, but we all do it. I mean, mm-hmm. We're all really drawn in by a beautiful cover image, and it looks so fantastic when placed among a variety of other attractive items. I mean, the things that some of these bookstagrammers come up with, I'm just in awe. One of the women that works for me is the one who runs our Instagram. And I remember when she wanted to create it, I was like, okay, cool. You know, I was like, that's fine. I feel like an old lady by comparison, because I finally just got on Instagram this past year. And I was like, can you help me set up my account? How does this stuff work? And she's like rolling her eyes at me like, oh my God, you're not that old. Like, this shouldn't be that challenging for you. And now I kind of like it, 'cause it's really fun. Pretty pictures all the time. And I remember her teaching me about lighting, and I was like, wait a minute, I am not a professional photographer. Like, it is not supposed to be complicated. Can I just point and shoot? And she was like, oh my God, no, you cannot do this. So she had me like watch her do some things, and I was like, this is a lot of time and effort, which is why some of my photos are like, do you really look like that at 6 a.m.? Yeah, I do. It's exactly what I fucking look like at 6 a.m. And that is why I took the photo.
You're like, you're doing a gritty realism on my Instagram feed?
Exactly. I mean, I'm grinning, but I also look exhausted doing my workout. And that's fine, because I am. It's reality, people. On the other hand, our Berkeley photos just look beautiful because Ryan really makes them look gorgeous. And we're a professional organization, so they really shouldn't look like crap. So that's fair. If she needs to take some time on that, totally fine. My photos, on the other hand, sometimes look like crap, and that's okay, because I'm not a professional photographer.
Fair. It's funny that you bring up Bookstagram or Instagram. I'm working on trying to get a Bookstagrammer on the podcast right now to explain it to the rest of us, because I think there are so many readers on Instagram. It's a huge audience, and I don't think there are very many authors who are utilizing it effectively as a platform to reach readers.
Yes.
You've got these sort of bookstagrammers who have figured it out and are doing it. And part of it is probably just how time consuming it is.
Yeah.
But I think there are some little things that authors could be doing to connect more on Instagram. So just getting, even just explaining that Bookstagram is Instagram, I've had to do a couple times recently. I didn't realize it at first. I was like, is there a different app where people are like bookstagramming? And they were like, no, it's Instagram for books.
I thought it was just the hashtag for people who are like, hey, I like books, guys, bookstagram. I didn't realize it was like whole photo shoots with books.
It's like a whole artistic movement where it's books as objects in a lot of cases.
Yes. And I guarantee there's a PhD thesis being written about that right now.
Probably.
The book as object as expressed in the digital space.
I'm sure. Yeah. But
I guess it's funny because I had a lot of authors a while ago say, what do you think about Pinterest? Should I be on there? I think Pinterest is a rabbit hole and I am terrified to get on there because I will never come out. So I really honestly avoid Pinterest because it's just so much. It's like so much data flying at you and too many images and I just can't harness it all. On the other hand, Instagram, it just feels a little simpler because you find your few things that you're going to follow. It pops up in a feed that is very much a sort of Facebook style. You're familiar with it. There's also feeds on Twitter. So you're kind of used to this always scrolling feed of, oh, pretty things. Also, I think the wonderful thing about Instagram is it's not offensive. Like by its very nature, it is not offensive. You generally don't have angry people making angry comments on Instagram. I mean, yes, there are always going to be people that do because we all get angry during the day. But in general, like,
have to express it on a stranger's comment.
And okay, cool. But I mean, in general, I feel like what people are posting on Instagram is pretty feel good stuff, or at least kind of entertaining, you know, realism stuff. Whereas I go on Twitter and I'm like, oh, nope, never mind. Getting back off, backing away from the lion's den. And Facebook has gotten to the point for me where it is a little overwhelming because I think once you have a certain number of friends, it's like, oh, okay, too much. But Instagram still feels very much like it's just pretty to look at. And I don't even have to read the captions if I don't want to. I can just look at the pictures.
Is Snapchat becoming a thing for authors?
Some authors are using it, though not as many as I imagined might. I don't know. I'm just not sure that medium is quite right unless the author is a significant like personality in and of themselves. And I think so many of the book reading audience is a little bit older and Snapchat still feels very young to me. Like I'm not on Snapchat at all and I will never get on Snapchat. Like that's just one too many things for me. On the other hand, one of the women that works for me, her younger brother is only on Snapchat and he talks about Facebook as for old people. And I was like, wow, okay.
Well, things change.
Guilty.
You know? But granted, my dad is on Facebook. So, you know, and
my grandma rocks Facebook.
Oh, right. I mean, my dad will actually like comment on my Facebook stuff. And I'm like, you know, you could call me. Text me. We're related. Why are you asking me a question on Facebook? Or he'll make like dad-like comments. And I'm always wondering, like, do people wonder why my dad is saying like weird shit on my Facebook? Like, probably.
I'm going to say no, they don't wonder because it's just like a fact. Universally acknowledged that like dads on Facebook will always make dad comments and you're like, that's a dad comment.
But, oh, totally.
We're adults and kind of can just pat them on the head and be like, oh, dad comment. Can you imagine what it would have been like to have a Facebook when that was embarrassing and it would be like, like socially crippling to you because good your dad got on and made a comment?
Good point.
Like, I think kids have it a lot harder now in that sense.
And also having to regulate the impulses to, you know, I posted some very embarrassing MySpace blog posts back in the day. I'm so grateful that they're all gone now. I mean, I'm sure they exist somewhere, but I'm pretty sure I deleted my entire profile. But it's got to be rough growing up. And I think we've talked about this before with your life under scrutiny in the digital space.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you alluded to sort of advising authors on platforms to use.
Yeah.
And that was another thing as a brand new author that was kind of overwhelming for me. And I think a lot of aspiring authors or first-time authors get right up against that, like, okay, I've got a book coming out, and then it's like, oh, what do I do?
Yeah.
What advice could you give that people could be doing to make your job easier and to make their lives easier when it comes to trying to get that book out to the world? What steps could they be taking ahead of time?
So I always recommend find what social media platforms work for you and stick to that. So I've got authors that rock Facebook on a regular basis, and they're like, I'm just not doing Twitter. Okay, that's fair. Because if it doesn't work for you and if it doesn't feel like your authentic voice, people will know. People always know because it sounds stilted or it sounds like you didn't know what to say. So you just said something so you could say something. And fair enough, we've all done that. But on a regular basis, what you're really trying to do is build community. You want to build, you know, authentic online relationships. I'm not talking making best friends with people, but at least having like friendly rapport so that if somebody, you know, makes a comment and references you, you can comment back. You know, you might be tagged in something funny. And if Facebook feels like you and what's easy for you to do, do it. If Instagram feels like you, do it. But if it doesn't, do not force something that isn't there. Because I think that's when you get very resentful of the platform and it just doesn't work well. And I always say begin building your platform as early as possible because it is really difficult when you have 5 followers to say, hey, my book's out, go buy it. Because even if all 5 do, that's still 5 people. You know, whereas if you begin your platform the moment that your book is contracted or ideally long before that, and you're just sort of commenting in the community, it's not self-promotion if you are commenting back and forth with another person and simply creating a digital relationship. That's not asking anything of someone. That is really just saying, oh, I'm interested in your content and I want to tell you that. And ideally, they will feel similarly as time goes on. You know, I know authors that have started their platform but don't really know any of the other authors published by Berkeley yet. And that's okay. I can introduce you. I can say, hey, I think that, you know, you've got a book coming out the same month as so-and-so. You guys should do like a joint giveaway on, you know, on your mutual Facebook pages. You should do this. You should try that. We have authors that were all contracted around the same time and realized that on Twitter because, you know, the woman that works for me that handles our Twitter account, Jessica, started tweeting like, welcome to the family to a whole bunch of different people right around the same time. And then they reached out to each other like, hey, I hear you're part of the Berkeley family now too. Cool. We're going to be like publishing sisters. And they just wind up striking up a friendship, which is amazing. Like ideally that is what will happen. And if you meet someone in person, then it is so much easier to engage with them on social media because they know who you are. They get your sense of humor. You know, it's just a much more natural way of doing things. And then when your book does come out and you're super excited saying, guys, check it out. My book is in the wild. Look at this photo of my book in Barnes & Noble, you know, or the local indie store, wherever that might be. It doesn't feel so kind of weird and like, buy my book, buy my book. I mean, yeah, obviously you want people to buy your book. They know that. But it doesn't feel as salesy when you have built up a following and an actual community of people that really enjoy hearing from you on a regular basis.
When they're authentically excited for you and yes. It's, you know, we're almost making it sound like a strategic manipulative relationship kind of thing that all has this end goal and it doesn't. It's, you yeah. know, it's has the potential to be more genuine than that. And yeah, absolutely. Ideally it gets to the spot where you put it out and they're championing it because yeah. they care.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, as an author, you're for a living doing something solitary. You are writing alone in most cases. There are writing duos, of course, but in general, your endeavor is a solitary one. The publishing process, on the other hand, not a solitary endeavor. But as an author, you really want to be able to interact with your readers. And until social media, the only method of doing that was they wrote to you either via a letter or then email. But your ability to interact with readers on a regular basis was very minimal. And it really was one-on-one. Whereas now you are offering people a bird's eye view into your writing life every day. You know, and whether that's by showing them your writing cave, like what your favorite beverage is while you write, perhaps all the laundry that you need to do because your book tour has been going on for a week and you're like, yep, this is all the laundry, people. This is the glamorous life of me on the road. You know, whatever the case might be, you're letting them see who you are in a more personal way so that when you comment back and forth, it feels like they know you a bit. And that's really exciting for a reader. I mean, when you welcome an author, you know, into your home, into your innermost emotional thoughts and feelings as you're reading this very romantic novel, you want to feel like you have some knowledge of who they are. And social media allows that in a way that we simply didn't have, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Let's talk about readers for a second, because we do tend to focus on authors, particularly on this podcast, because that's who we're interviewing and that experience. And I think that's really fascinating to know about. But I don't think very many readers realize just how much of an impact they can have doing small things.
Yeah.
So as a publicist, can you tell us, you know, you love an author. Mm-hmm. What can you do that makes an impact for them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as a reader, one of the most impactful things that you can do is obviously buy the author's books, because that's a vote of confidence that you love what they're doing and you want to support them.
Do pre-orders matter?
Pre-orders do indeed matter. You know, it's interesting. Times have evolved. So pre-orders, you know, can be collected very, very early on. I mean, books are going up online about 9 months before publication, maybe even a little bit more, depending. And you can pre-order as soon as it's up there. So, I mean, go for it, folks, especially if it's somebody that you love. And I love the pre-order thing because it's like a surprise to me. When it downloads, I get like that little alert from the iBook store. Hey, your book's here. And I'm like, yes, because then I can, you know, start it immediately. That's always very exciting. Or it arrives in the mail if you're, you know, reading physically. And that's also like, who doesn't like a package arriving on their doorstep when it's a happy package? That's always great. And then in addition to, you know, buying the book, if you loved it, tell somebody, you know, tell your friend, your mom, your brother, your dad, whoever. And tell somebody online, recommend it in, you know, Facebook groups that you're in, or to other readers that, you know, and maybe have similar taste with, or think they should try something new. Talk about it on, you know, if you prefer to review on Amazon or wherever, give the book a star rating. Goodreads, obviously, that is a fantastic community if you're a reader and want to talk about books. Letting other people know, you know, because I think the wonderful thing when another reader makes a recommendation to me is that's somebody that really has no skin in the game. You know, if they love a book, they simply love a book. And if we have similar taste, then I'm really swayed because I think, oh, well, this is my friend. I love a lot of what they love. And if they're telling me that this is good stuff, I'm going to give it a whirl. You know, I think it's one of the reasons that so many bloggers have seen a lot of success, because they are readers just like you guys and me. They really are. They might blog for a living, but many of them don't. So they read simply for the joy. Because trust me, what many of them are making off affiliate links is nothing. So they really are reading for the pure joy and to be able to talk about it with other reading obsessed people. So if they love it, then I'm like, okay, I will probably love it too. Let me give this a whirl.
I'm curious your thoughts on ebook piracy, because there's a school of thought that says an author should just be happy that someone wants to read their book and that any publicity is good publicity. And then the school I tend to subscribe to is like, if you love it and you would be like, if and you would be willing to pay for a cup of coffee or, you know, a fancy cocktail, like, please buy the book. What do you what is your perspective from someone who is actively trying to continue these authors' careers?
Yeah, my perspective is always going to be buy the book. And it's not like there aren't other options. I mean, there's the library. Anyone can go to the library and get a library card. Literally anyone. And especially now, you can also get ebooks from the library. So there really are so many great options. Even if you're not able to buy, say, a full price hardcover, that's okay. Go to the library. And so many libraries now allow you to even reserve the book in advance and, you know, be on a wait list. And then you get a little alert when it's time for the book to come up for you to, you know, go get or download if you're, you know, a digital person. And I just think, don't you want to support the author? Because it's like anything else. If you can't make a living doing it, you do need to support yourself. And that's how you make your money. I mean, I would not want to do my job for free. I'm just putting that out there. Like, it would be very difficult to survive in New York doing my job for free. I would not live in my home. So I think that we all too often get into the mentality of, well, it doesn't really matter if I buy this book because somebody else will. And I think that can be dangerous, because if enough of us get to that point where we're like, oh, I'm not going to buy this book, somebody else will. Well, no, I mean, eventually nobody will. Like, that's that's the idea. If we treat someone's blood, sweat, tears, hours of work as not worth it. Like, that's not cool.
And if you're downloading things, you're encouraging the people who have been illegally uploading. They're like, oh, there's a demand, I'm going to keep doing it.
Yes, exactly.
I do think it's hard, though, as an author. Like, I think we can all agree, don't do bad things. Like, don't illegally download. You know, it's bad.
Of course.
But I do see other authors getting really upset when their books are up on those sites. And I get Google alerts that mine is up there all the time. And I think that's where it's like, you've got to just step back and be like, I can, till I'm blue in the face, scream, don't do it. But it's going to happen. And it's like Hydra if you try and go and hunt them down. Like, you cut one of them off and it just pops up in 10 more places.
There was a YA author who had a really interesting blog post where she'd noticed a drop in digital sales and then was convinced it was related to piracy. So she deliberately flooded all of these sites with the first four chapters of her book. And so that was the only thing people could download. And then her sales bounced back up.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Which I thought was really interesting. Maybe you should upload an illegal version of yours, but only the first.
But I think that's where, that mentality of like any publicity is good publicity. You're like, all right, if people, they're going to do it. There are people out there who are going to ignore everything we're saying. So you just sort of hope, all right, maybe they love it and they tell their friend who does want to be a decent human being and purchase it. And you just kind of have to step back and there's not the internet police is not effective at dealing with book piracy or music piracy or movie piracy. So.
No, that's so true. And I do think that the other thing that a lot of people don't even consider is that sometimes what you think you're downloading isn't what you're downloading, folks. Yeah. Like, you could be downloading anything. It might be called your author's favorite new novel. Like, that might be the name on the file that you believe you are downloading to your computer. That does not mean that is what is going to download to your computer. So even just from the standpoint of protect your digital devices, you might not actually be getting what you think you are. You could be getting like a terrible, horrible, gross virus that is just going to eat your digital life. Yeah. And you don't want that either.
Or a fake version. There was someone who had downloaded a version of Harry Potter. And I think there was like, it was like an erotica version, but he thought it was the real books.
Serves him right.
Yeah, that's actually hilarious.
And he was like, gosh, I can't believe this is for kids.
Talking about some of those digital trends and, you know, maybe a more positive but challenging one that I feel like I've noticed and I've wondered how it's impacted the strategy behind publicity is with people kind of cutting the cord with cable, there's this instantaneous satisfaction. We get seasons of stuff dumped on us instead of having to wait. So everyone has gotten used to binging.
Yes.
We binge watch and if we're readers, we binge read. So I want 13 books in the series to be out. I don't want to, you know, that model of the Harry Potter model that we grew up with where, you know, you maybe get one a year.
Yeah.
I feel like we've sort of had to move away from because we've gotten so used to that instant gratification.
Yes.
Has that impacted the strategy on your end of like the publishing house? Are you guys thinking differently about how and when to release books?
Yeah, it's interesting because we've experimented a lot over the years. And I do remember, I think it was maybe even when I was back at Dorchester, we tried publishing books like only 2 or 3 months apart in the same series, which at that time was pretty unusual. And this was obviously long before self-publishing. So people simply were not putting books out that quickly, certainly not in the same series or world. And it was really cool because there were readers that were so excited because it wasn't necessarily that there was a cliffhanger at the end of the book, but you could tell who your secondary characters were that were very likely to wind up together. And you really wanted to see that next relationship right away. And only having to wait, you know, 60 or 90 days was pretty exciting by comparison to, you know, a year or even 6 months. So we have continued to experiment a bit with that, but it's like anything else. It works with some things and not with others. You know, I think it can work for some authors and not others. I think it can work for certain types of fiction and again, not others. And it's a very, I think recently, it's very much a self-publishing world thing because I have seen a lot of self-published authors be able to put out manuscripts pretty close to every 3 months. And in the traditionally published model, that is simply not possible. There are too many hands that need to be put on a book. There is too much processing. even from the standpoint of ordering the paper alone, like you just can't accomplish all these tasks as quickly as one would need to. Whereas if you are self-publishing a novel, I mean, your time is really only dependent upon how much sleep you need, you know, essentially how much sleep you and, you know, whoever you're working with to kind of do some of the quality control stuff and the line editing, you know, need. And that's really all there is to it. But in terms of the binging, you know, I do think that there are people now that once they try the first book in a series, especially if we're quite a ways into the series, there's just no concept of like stopping now. It's like, oh, okay, well, I finally decided to read this first book in a series that my friend recommended, and there's 15 more. So I'm going to read those all in the space of 2 weeks, which like we have all done. I mean, I think mm-hmm. it was 1 or 2 Christmases ago? I went home over break and I read the entire Vampire Academy series in 7 days. And then my mom also read it in like, you know, probably 2 weeks or so. And I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to see anybody. I didn't really want to interact with my family because I was like, excuse me, I have some vampires to get back to. And, you know, that's kind of my mode. When I find something that I haven't started before and I know that there's a number of books that I can potentially go through, uh-oh, rabbit hole time. You know, I will do this anytime I find something new. Whereas if it's an author that I know and love, chances are I've already read all of the previous stuff. So in order to fill up the time in between, you know, their next release, I just binge a whole bunch of other stuff. And that's why I think whenever people get nervous about, well, I'm not putting out books, you know, fast enough. And like, yeah, we would all like George R.R. Martin to write a little bit faster. Like, okay, sure. I mean, there's definitely like those situations, but let's be clear. Fantasy authors are not known for being the quickest writers in the world. They have a lot of world building to do. They have a lot of like dragons to deal with. I get it. But romance authors, typically, if they're traditionally published, the shortest period of time is usually 6 months. Longest is probably a year, maybe a little more depending, you know, if they're a hardcover author. But anybody that ever worries, like, I'm not producing fast enough, no one's ever going to come back to my books, I'm like, the truth is you could never write fast enough for your readers. Absolutely never. Because they would want a book every day of the year. They just would. I know I do. Like, I would want to read a Nalini Singh book every day of the year. She literally cannot produce them fast enough for me. So if I can find a million other authors in between, like, you know, one release and the next, fantastic. Because then when they come out with their next book, you know, whatever, 6 months from now, excellent. I've got that to, you know, to go back to. And yes, I am the nerd that has like little alerts set up in my calendar that's like, next book is coming out, or I have pre-ordered and then it just like shows up by magic, which is awesome. It's like the universe knows what I'm ready for. So it's pretty cool. Yeah.
So that's, we've now alluded to your reading habits, which is a good bridge into a story I thought we should probably share, which is in, I think, what, our second episode?
Yeah.
We were talking, so the topic was our firsts and our favorites, our being Sarah and me.
Yeah.
And we talked in detail about the very first disastrous romance novel that I gave.
When Jenny recommended like polyamorous chic with Benoit Balls and all sorts of interesting stuff.
One of my high school best friends still has my copy of it. Elissa, I want it back. We had forgotten who the author was and we're trying to figure it out. And of course, Erin just immediately knew exactly what it was and shot me an email and said, this is Connie Mason. So,
oh yeah,
mystery solved.
Yep.
It was The Shake by, or Shake? Is there even a the in it? By Connie Mason. No, and we're going to put the cover in the show notes because you have to go look at it. And
oh, it's magnificent.
He's like lounging and it's, yeah, just so good. But then that just took Erin and I down a rabbit hole of, I was like, Connie Mason, of course.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember distinctly now that I had gone down like a binging Connie Mason phase because I guess there just wasn't as much on the internet and I wanted like that guarantee that it was going to be filthy at that time.
Oh, and Connie's like, a dirty bird. So yeah. That's what you were going to get.
So like, I wasn't going to mess around with like authors I didn't know yet. Yeah. I was like, nope, Connie Mason is a guarantee that this is going to have the right amount of filth in it for me at that time. So
absolutely.
Yeah. It's funny. Like, I'm sure I'd be fine with it now. It was just as my first like, oh, I don't know. Like, I'm a little nervous about reading sex. Like, I read literary fiction. Like, this is this is not actually what I sounded like, I hope. But I was very nervous about reading like a book with where people did it. And so maybe it was a little much for that first time.
So what was your first time?
Oh, gosh. So the truth is that my very first romance, I can't remember because I read so many stolen off my mom's shelf around the age of 14. I do remember one book called, I know the heroine's name was Sage, but I can't actually, I've never found the book ever again. I have gone looking, I'm guessing it probably wasn't called Sage, and that's why I still haven't found it. But I do know the very first romance novel that I ever bought, and that was Willow by Nora Hess. Good old Nora Hess. And I purchased that book on the way back from a vacation that I took from my grandparents. So we were about to get on a plane, and I really wanted a romance novel to read. So that is what was in the airport bookstore. But I was also very concerned that my grandparents would not feel it was appropriate for me to be reading this romance novel. So sly, I bought an issue of 17 magazine to wrap around the book. Yes, I was that person on a plane. I was probably, ninth grade, I think. So I was probably at that point, I had just turned 15 because I'd been reading romance for probably around a year, a little more at that point. And that was my very first book that I purchased. And I went on to read many, many Nora Hess books. And I mean, if anybody else read those back in the day, like Nora Hess was somewhat similar to Connie Mason in terms of, you know, the dirty level, and absolutely fantastic for so many reasons. You know, it's funny because I look back at all of those early books that I read and so many heroines were, you know, 18 and the hero was 30, 35, 36. And like, I couldn't read that now in the way that I did back then. Yeah. But that's the cool thing about romance, right? Is that the time it's written during is so reflective of our culture at the time it was written. And that's the awesome thing about romance novels, because I go back now and I look at stuff that was published 20 years ago and I'm like, oh, okay. I don't think I could feel the same way about that now that I do today, but fascinating that like that was my introduction to the romance world. I mean, I look at the futuristics that I read, like, oh, Jackie Casto and, oh, Dara Joy back in the day, and just all of those fun books that, you know, I definitely feel differently about now because my tastes are different. But at 15, 16, I mean, this was stuff that was absolutely like mind-altering in some ways. You know, women really asking for what they wanted, and sex being such a positive thing, and a healthy thing, you know, when with somebody that you love and care about and loves and cares about you in return. And I think that that's actually incredibly healthy. I wish more parents advocated, you know, romance novels for their daughters and sons, because mm-hmm. let me tell you, the sons could learn something. Yeah. It'd be a lot more satisfied women in their college years.
And also just issues of consent, especially a lot of the books that are coming out now where explicit consent is a thing. And it's really wonderful that we're going to have all of these books for teenagers, you know, casually leave it lying around.
This is a realization that I've had, that I've become the old lady who's like, that's not YA. Like, that's got sex in it. That's not YA. And I'm like, I was 11 and reading Connie Mason.
Yes.
And like, this idea that we're going to shield, you know, 13, 14-year-olds from sex by not putting it in the books that they're reading.
Yeah.
Is sort of absurd. And it's embarrassing to realize that I was falling into that category of like, A Court of Thorns and Roses is not YA. It's got sex. And you're like, wouldn't you rather they were seeing it there than seeing it somewhere that's not a healthy, like just going looking for porn on the internet?
Right.
There was a really interesting Twitter debate going on where it was like, oh, you know, like retweet if you want more new adult that isn't erotica. And I'm like, I don't think any of these new adult books are erotica. I don't, I want more new adult books, but the implication that like there was something bad about ones that had sex in it. It was like, oh, this is erotica.
Yeah.
And they're going to go looking for it. Like, that was.
And like, don't you want them to see that you can like enjoy it and it doesn't have to be like some horrible chore you do for other people? Like,
oh, absolutely.
That's not a concept I would want my kids thinking.
No, definitely not. And it is funny when you think about when you started reading romance novels, it's like, oh, okay, well, I was reading them, if we're going to use these terms, like far, far before the quote unquote appropriate age. But by the same token, you know, what you're reading is like, oh, okay, if it's done in a healthy way, then that's a good aspirational thing. Obviously, we all know that some 80s and early 90s romances did not have explicit consent. And that is, again, very reflective of how we responded to women's sexuality at that time. You know, so I'm really glad that consent, you know, is discussed explicitly, because when people try and say things to me like, well, but when you're on a date, like, it's not real sexy to talk about, like, in a restaurant or at a bar or wherever, like, you know, do you want to go have sex with me? And it's like, have you read a romance novel? Because it can be real sexy, folks. Mm-hmm. Like, when done correctly, when treated as, hey, I respect you as a human, and like, I would really like to get it on with you in my apartment 10 blocks away from here. How do you feel about that? Obviously, you know, I'm assuming that the gentleman's going to say it to me like a little sexier than that. And ideally with perhaps a phone sex operator voice. But like, that is great. I would rather have expectations out there on the table to clarify and see what each of our comfort level is, and to view that as like a really healthy, sexy thing that you have that much confidence, than to wind up in these super awkward situations where it's like, oh, is this their expectation? This isn't actually what I want to do. And I love that romance novels advocate that, you know? I think that's awesome.
It's like, I also think it's so important to have the conversations about like sitting down and being like, okay, like, I'm interested in getting sexually active with you. Like, have you been tested? I've been tested.
Yeah.
Like, it took me a long time to be like, that is a thing people have to do. And once you start doing that and taking the plunge, you're like, oh, wait, this is setting it up so I don't have to be anxious later. You know, this is setting up so you can just get caught up in the moment and some future day. And like, that's hot. And
you're not about to do it. And you're like, wait.
Oh, hold on. I forgot.
But you haven't. And now do I stop you? And and it's, I don't know, it's such a different world now with Tinder and social media, and everything just seems so much more casual, and in some ways it's out there like that, but I don't know, stuff like that, I'm like, I'm just glad I'm married.
Like, you're turning into an old lady.
I totally am. I'm like, I don't want to deal with that anymore.
Oh no, this Tinder business.
Yeah, I've had that conversation too many times. Like, my midwife ran an STD test recently because they check that so that they know if there's stuff they have to, precautions they have to take for the baby after the fact. And I was like, man, I remember a time when like that was a serious business. Like in college, we would go to Planned Parenthood and like get tested. And there was like, you know, a few times where I was like, am I okay? Yeah. And now I'm like, yeah, of course. Like, you know, of course there's the women who think that, and really someone's been out cheating and they discover it that way. But
yeah,
it's a different world.
Yes, indeed.
So what are you reading right now? Like, are you on like a paranormal kick? Or are you on? I know you said like Nalini Singh, and I was like, ooh, yeah. I love her stuff too.
I love Nalini. I am desperately awaiting her next manuscript, because I think she is working on final edits right now with her editor. So I like so casually like poke her editor like once or twice a week. So where are things with the manuscript?
Wait, do you do publicity for her?
Yeah. I'm Nalini's publicist.
Good. Okay.
So I just wait for the editor to come back and be like, calm down. I will give it to you. When it is time. I'm like, oh, okay, fine. But actually what I'm reading right now, this is the cool thing about having other publicist friends, is that you can sometimes get other books, you know, early. So I'm reading Christina Dodd's Dead Girl Running, because I'm on a little bit of a suspense kick at the moment. And I'm excited to read this because I have been a longtime fan of Christina, and years ago was her publicist when she was at NAL, at Penguin. So she and my author, Jane Ann Krentz, who also writes as Amanda Quick, are going to go kind of on the road together and do a couple of events in May. So I was, you know, emailing back and forth with her publicist, and I was like, you know, if you'd like to do a book exchange, I will send you Jane's Amanda Quick novel if you will send me Christina's novel. And she was like, no problem. I have ARCs. I'll put one in the mail to you now. And I was like, yes. So I am reading it right now, which is awesome. She just does a great job with like Pacific Northwest set suspense. And she always has some really interesting kind of quirky characters in these smaller towns that she sets up. And I also love in particular what she's done with her recent books because they are so heroine driven. And I really love a book that is focused on the majority is focused on the female character. I just find that so fun and interesting. And that I get to kind of meet the man through her eyes. And, you know, no doubt, I also appreciate getting the male perspective sometimes too. But that's like, are you in the mood for that today or not? And at the moment, I'm in the mood for all ladies all the time. So this is great. But yeah, after this one, I'll probably switch it up and do something different. Because I tend to go on kicks. Like I had read a bunch of romantic suspense over the holidays. So now I will probably transition to something else. And I usually just sort of wait and see like, okay, what do I feel like as soon as I finish something? Because sometimes it's like, oh my God, I need more suspense. And other times I'll go, okay, I've had enough suspense now. I want like a historical or, oh, I just want something like real filthy. So what's that going to be this time? And I remember, I think it was Sarah McLean who recommended to me, like probably around a year ago. She was like, Erin, have you read Cressley Cole's Game Maker series? And I was like, no. And you know, so many people have told me that I should.
That is some spicy stuff.
And she was like, do not delay. You need to get on that immediately. And I was like, oh, okay. So I got the first two books and I was like, oh, this is why Sarah said I needed to read these immediately. Cause yeah. And as soon as I finished the first two, I bought the third one. I mean, I think I read all three in like under a week. And I came to work one day and I remember I was looking like a little rough around the edges. And people were like, what did you do last night? And I was like, I read Cressley Cole.
Me and Cressley had,
you know, and it's just like people do occasionally, like I'm probably the one person in my department that could say, like coming into work looking like a total mess and be like, yeah, I was reading a manuscript last night. And people would just be like, oh, right, of course. You know, like not surprised at all. Because that's sort of my deal. Like I stay up too late reading and I'm the one that like doesn't want to know what time it is when I finish. So I cover the clocks in my home nights that I'm going to read late and then I don't know. So I could have gone to bed at 11:30. It's unlikely that I went to bed at 11:30 because I started the book at 10:30. So it's unlikely, but like in my mind, I could have. When I wake up feeling nauseated and like I can't open my eyeballs, chances are I didn't go to bed at 11:30. But like that little bit of plausible deniability is like, maybe I did though. Maybe I did. And I can get through the day. It's going to be fine.
Wait, which is your favorite in that series?
Oh, book two, actually.
Mine too. Yeah. The Master.
Which,
that's the one where he like keeps his one night sex
yep, that's higher, my favorite too.
Up in I his do, like penthouse.
I love her.
I mean,
she's great.
She's just so saucy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it's Miami. And the way that she like parades in front of him, like, you know you want this. And I am just going to really like do crazy shit to up, like just give you some general upheaval. I mean, when she starts ordering thousands and thousands of dollars worth of shit to this penthouse, I was like, go girl. Because it's really not about her taking advantage of him. It's her like laying down the law that, okay, you think you're in control, but watch what I will do. And I was like, this is the sexiest shit I have ever seen. It was awesome.
Yeah. So we're going to jump into our rapid fire questions. But before do that, I'm just sitting here and had a random question for you. And that was that there have to be times where there are books that you really love that you're trying to get out there and they just don't, it doesn't take off. They don't get the traction.
Yeah.
And is there one that you could suggest to us from, could be recently or it could be a while ago that just
okay.
Or if you wanted.
Yeah. Okay. Or just that you liked and it really just didn't get the attention that you felt like it should have and it didn't really take off. And books, if there isn't, that's fine. But I just thought it was an opportunity to throw one of those out to the universe as a recommendation.
Holy, holy moly. Let's think. So I've been fortunate that a lot of the things that I was really, really passionate about, we did get nice attention for. But there's always like those few books that you just wish were even bigger or that, you know, maybe came out a little bit before their time in certain ways. And one that always comes to mind immediately, and this book did get attention online, but I really do believe that there's a lot of people that would still get enjoyment out of it, is Asking for It by Lila Pace. And speaking of consent, that is such a fascinating book. And I always preface the book with this. If you find a woman that has a rape fantasy triggering, please be aware that that's what you're going to go in and read. Please also be aware that there is no rape in the book ever on page. That does not happen. The fantasy that she has is that she will get to explore this experience in a controlled environment with someone that she trusts. So that's what she sets up. A power dynamic exchange with someone who agrees to certain parameters, similar to the way that you would agree to things in a BDSM relationship. And the exploration of her psyche, her guilt, her shame, and her emotions around the way that she, you know, enjoys sex and the feelings that she develops for the hero is simply some of like the best reads, you know, the best written stuff I have read, particularly that explores this issue. And I know that a lot of people were really anxious going into it because the rape fantasy is not one that I have, and it's normally one that I would be turned off by. And yet when the editor gave me this book, I trust her opinion implicitly. And when Cindy said to me, "You've got to read this. This is up your alley," I was like, "I think you're a little crazy, but okay." And I started the book and I was like, "Oh my God, I am so excited that we are going to publish this book because this is incredible." And it really did allow me to have the shame conversation with people because I understood, if not what the heroine was going through from a literal level, I understood what the point the author was trying to make was that we each have some sort of fantasy or something that we, you know, enjoy that for whatever reason, we think people won't love us because of it, you know, and that is what you were able to explore in this book. Like, what is that thing for you? So I loved it. And I always encourage people that if they're willing to give it a try, even if they're apprehensive, I really think that the book is magic and they should give it a whirl. And these two books have not come out yet, but they're ones that I am constantly talking about. Or I guess I should say three. I mean, a lot of people have probably heard of The Wedding Date by Jasmine Guillory at this point. I wholeheartedly recommend. And if I had to give two other books for 18 that I'm super excited about, I'm going to talk about debut authors because that's not something we get the opportunity to discuss a lot. And those would be Helen Huang's The Kiss Quotient, which is magnificent. Like, just read it. It's phenomenal. It's a little bit of a reverse Pretty Woman, and the heroine has Asperger's, and she hires a professional to help her get better at dating and sex. Awesome. And of course, she falls in love with him. And it's really, really a fun book. It's got heart. It's got humor. It's got culture clash. And just, I absolutely adored it. And I love that we own two more books by this author. And yes, I have already read the second manuscript called The Bride Test, and it's magnificent too. So then the other book that I would recommend is Intercepted by Alexa Martin, which is so damn fun and sassy. So Alexa happens to be a football wife because her husband was an NFL player, Super Bowl champion. And now in like a really adorable Friday Night Lights turn of events, he coaches high school football. But she knows what she's writing about because she writes about a heroine who is a football girlfriend and what her kind of experience is. And it's such a beautiful romance. And also this heroine, holy moly, is she like sassy and has the best internal dialogue. Like when she lets out zingers, they're the kind of zingers that she'll say to people and it takes them a good 10 seconds to realize they've been insulted, but then it's too late because the conversation has moved on. And I just want like to have this woman's like mouth inside of my brain so that when I need to get somebody with a zinger, I can just like let her out. But yeah, those are my excited in 2018 books.
Did we not all just get a glimpse of why Erin is good at her job?
Yeah, I know. I'm like, I want to tell me
that you're not immediately going and like, I'm excited about all of those. And they're also different and not necessarily what I would be reading.
Yeah, it's funny. I never like, would I have picked to read up it now. A football romance. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, wait, this sounds interesting.
So good. I mean, this is why I love what I do, though. Like, I've had people say to me before, "You're so genuine." And I'm like, well, that's because I really have set up my entire life and career around books that I absolutely adore. Not many people get to say that, but I do. Like, I don't have to fake it. I mean,
it's going to make a huge difference that you're promoting what you love and it's coming from a really genuine place.
It is. It's so fun to do what I do.
Okay, well then we're going to leap right into the rapid fire questions.
Oh my gosh, I'm nervous now. Okay, here we go.
So very high
pressure.
We
usually
situation.
Ask about authors' workspaces and they're in a private place. So I'm assuming this might limit you since yours is in a publishing house. But what is the most interesting object that is in your workspace?
Oh, interesting. Well, I don't know if I can pick out one. I will say that my office is known as the place where if the zombie apocalypse came, you want to hide in my office. The reason for that is that I have extra clothing, shoes, umbrellas, just in case you need to beat someone off with one, so much candy, food, alcohol, multiple bottles of champagne and wine. So many tote bags. I mean, I think you could form like
champagne and tote bags. Yeah. Is like your zombie preparation strategy.
I mean, the stuff in my office is kind of ridiculous. When I had to move from one office to another, it took me 24 moving boxes. Not normal and not advisable. And yes, both women that worked for me judged me the entire time. I mean, appropriately so. It was ridiculous. But I have so much crap in my office. It is like not to be believed.
Okay. Do you have any irrational hatreds?
I mean, Brussels sprouts, which I say I'm allergic to. Actually, not true, but I say I'm allergic to them. And I'm going to borrow this from an author because when he said it the other day, I was like, yes. Mid-season or fall finales of TV shows. What the hell is that nonsense? There is no such thing as a fall finale. And honestly, how fucking dare you? Like, what is wrong with you that you're going to make me wait 6 weeks for the next episode with some ludicrous, ludicrous cliffhanger? No, I do not accept. So yes, I do have an irrational hatred of that.
Amen. I don't know that that's irrational though. Okay, this is a publicist nightmare question probably, but the zombie apocalypse is happening and we're hiding in your office. Mm-hmm. And you can only save one work of fiction.
Oh my God.
What is it?
Oh no.
Aaron's head just exploded.
It really did. That's like asking me to pick like a child, which is so, so hard. Okay. So I'm going to cheat a little bit. And this is not in my office, but if it were, and I'm going to use this because I don't have an author that wrote this book. So Dean Koontz's The Odkins. It is the book that I reread once a year at Christmas time because my parents gave it to me on my 8th Christmas and they wrote an inscription in the beginning of the book. If you haven't read it, you can probably buy it for $300 on Amazon Marketplace or eBay. But it's called The Odkins, A Fable for All Ages. And it is the first book it's the first time that I saw my dad cry while reading this book. And it's a book that he read to me every night until we finished it. I think it's 5 or 6 chapters. It's beautifully illustrated. And it is one of the most heartwarming stories, just kind of about like friendship and the human spirit. And I now cry every time I read it. So that's the book that I would save.
Aww. What a great answer.
All right. Who is your favorite book boyfriend?
Okay. This is actually, right now, this is an easy one for me. And that would be Rourke from J.D. Robb's Eve Dallas series. Because I live in New York, and if I was going to marry a sexy New Yorker, it would be Rourke. Because the man is literally sex on a stick. He's like a gajillionaire. And he comes with a butler, like a snarky, sarcastic butler. Also, I would have an auto chef because I'd live in his house that is filled with fancy auto chefs and never, ever have to cook again. Never have to cook again. That is my dream. No joke. If there's anybody out there who is a private chef listening to this podcast and you are also attractive and male and live in New York, find me. Please.
Preferably single.
I mean, but preferably. I don't think I'm polyamorous, but if you're a private chef and really attractive, I might be willing to consider it if you're going to cook for me on a daily basis. Just saying.
Makes sense to me. Would you rather be forgotten or hatefully remembered?
Oh, man, that's a hard one. I really don't want people to hate me, but I really also want to be remembered. That is such a good question. I guess forgotten, though, because I don't want to be hatefully remembered. So, yeah, I'd want to be forgotten.
Okay. Who was your first celebrity crush?
Okay, no one is going to know this. Literally no one. But my first celebrity crush was in the Annie Potts ABC TV version of Dangerous Minds. And he played the character Guzmán López. His name is Greg Serrano. He was also on the ABC family show Wildfire, and he played Pablo. I have followed his career.
Gonna go down a Google rabbit hole as soon as we get off of here.
My teenage self loved him.
Okay, in a game of fuck, marry, kill, and I'm going to spice things up by throwing a book boyfriend in here and see what happens.
Oh boy, okay, okay.
We have yet to topple Idris Elba and Jason Momoa, but I'm putting Zadist from the Black Dagger Brotherhood in there.
Oh my God, okay, okay. All right, so I have to tell you guys this first because you're going to get a kick out of this. So I was explaining like my extreme love for Jason Momoa's body to a literary agent the other day.
It had to be explained.
It's a very important professional conversation.
Right? And her husband is in the entertainment industry, and he referred to Jason Momoa, and I just thought this was fascinating, as the pumpkin spice of actors. And that is to say, not appropriate in all circumstances, but when you want it, nothing else will do. And I was like, yeah.
That's...
Yeah, I mean, totally appropriate. Okay, so... All right, well, I mean, Zadist I'm marrying. Like, there's just no question about that. I will marry Zadist. I mean, I want to heal him. I want him in my life forever. I want him to write in almost illegible handwriting, "I love you." Oh, like, that made me cry. If it doesn't make you cry, you're not human. Okay. Oh, the choice between Jason Momoa and Idris Elba. This is painful. I'm not going to lie. So, but I'm going to have to fuck Jason Momoa and kill Idris Elba. I didn't think there was ever a situation in which I could do that, but sometimes you need pumpkin spice, and that's really just all there is to it.
You need it.
It just happened.
All right. It happened. All right. We're going out to a bar together. Okay. What is your drink of choice?
Okay. Depends on the mood, but in 90% of circumstances, it will be something with tequila, probably like a fancy tequila cocktail, because tequila is always the correct choice under any set of circumstances. It is my favorite liquor, which I realize is insane because that is not true for most people, but I have never had a bad tequila experience because I enjoy it so much that I have ensured I have never had a bad tequila experience. The other 10% of the time, it is generally a bourbon drink. Mm-hmm. Because I my friend Erica said this to me once, and it's probably true. She said, "You drink like you have a 10-inch dick." And I had been saying I drink like an 80-year-old man, but I really like the 10-inch dick illusion a lot better.
Yeah. It's funny. I just found out that people like can sip tequila, like really fancy tequila, because like we're both like Scotch people. Oh, like a good
añejo? Yeah.
But then I also recently had like a tequila old-fashioned, I think, or maybe it was a mezcal old-fashioned.
Yep.
Whatever. It was delicious.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had this magnificent ginger añejo tequila cocktail the other night, and it rocked my world. It was delicious.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I'm a Scotch girl 100%, but there were a few years in a row there that I was going to a tequila tasting event with my husband and his work people, and going, I was like, "You are not making me do this. Like, this is awful." He's like, "No, it's going to be fine." It was like tequila and cigars, and it was really high-end tequila.
Oh, yeah.
And sure enough, I was like, "Oh, I've been drinking tequila out of a plastic bottle. This is the problem."
Yeah, or like doing body shots.
Yeah.
Oh, like, not the same.
I've been abusing tequila.
The good stuff is totally different.
Yeah. So I did learn that lesson, but all right, next question. What Hogwarts house would you be in? And I feel like by this time in the interview, I feel like I can normally pinpoint it, and I don't know with you.
I got to be honest. Okay.
Oh, no.
I'm like really afraid to say this out loud. I think I might actually just be like a Hufflepuff, guys.
Oh, okay.
Don't be afraid. A lot of our authors are Hufflepuffs.
Okay. I thought you were going to say you like hate Harry Potter or something.
Yeah, or
no.
Like hadn't read it.
No, Hufflepuff. Yeah, no, okay. That's a totally acceptable answer. Good.
No one hates on Hufflepuffs anymore. Like, okay. Everyone wants to be a Hufflepuff these
days. Oh, good. That makes me feel better. Yeah, all right, thank you.
And it's like now that we live in such a nightmare apocalypse scape, like everyone wants to be sweet and kind and loving.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you for making me feel that way.
Yeah. All right. Do you want invisibility or super strength?
Oh. I do like to feel badass, so I think I want super strength.
Oh.
I'd like to see you with super strength.
Right? I feel like it'd be awesome.
Erin is like a petite woman.
Like
so
if I could just like pick up you a like car and be like, car, yeah, I did that. That'd be pretty cool.
I like it. Well, we usually ask authors and those types of people where, you know, if people want to go follow them,
yeah,
would you want your personal accounts or would you rather direct us to Berkeley?
I mean, you're welcome to follow me on Instagram at Erin D. Galloway, but you probably don't care all that much about my workout photos, though I do post books and I post a lot of food stuff. So don't worry, like not food that I make generally, because that's not always pretty. But I post a lot of drink shots, so feel free to follow me. But the really cool stuff would be at Berkeley Romance on Instagram, at Berkeley Romance on Twitter, and at Berkeley Romance on Facebook.
Perfect.
And don't worry, our Instagram person, Ryan, takes way better photos than I do on my personal one. So like, it's a good time.
Yeah, they're worth going and looking at just to see that,
well,
like,
thank you.
That you can do something that pretty with books.
Yes. Like,
there's a feeling to the pictures.
Exactly. Aspirational, cool. As we like to say.
Well, thank you for taking the time in LA to come and see us. Oh,
thank you for having me. This was awesome. Delightful. Yeah, I love chatting romance. Great.